With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. For a little bit of context, we just wanted you to know that a lot of these were recorded before quarantine. And as we know, a lot has changed in 2020. So again, please stay safe out there. And enjoy the new episodes of And the Writer Is. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's incomparably iconic, magnificently brilliant entrepreneur is not just a judge on television's most popular music program, is not just a fashion trend-setting designer, but is also a nice local ska kid from the OC. No doubt her many Grammy, Billboard, and MTV awards come from not only her front woman days of one of the most influential bands, but also from her international multi-platinum successful solo career. With many tens of millions of units sold worldwide, this woman's most impressive virtue is always on display, her humility. All the way from a couple miles away, or Oklahoma, this mother and fiance is a model for how all of us can evolve, not just as songwriters, artists, and fans, but as family people. And the writer is, let me reintroduce my co-writer and my friend, the great Gwen Stefani.
Oh my gosh, you are such an amazing writer. Wow. And you probably did that in like 2 seconds as well.
Exactly.
That would take me like a month to try to rewrite it and look up all the spelling on spell check.
Oh, yeah. Well, nobody ever looks at the spelling. I will say that. That's kind of a win. But it's good to see you.
Too.
I feel like we spend a lot of time on Zoom these days.
It's so weird, too, because I didn't discover you had this podcast until after I worked with you, I think. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I mean, that probably makes sense. And I appreciate you being a longtime listener now.
Yes.
But I know a lot of this is, you know, Wikipedia-able, and you've had a lot of, you've had plenty of interviews about your career thus far. But I just kind of want to talk about it similar to how we talked about it the first time we met. You know, it's just, you start, tell me about your childhood. You're in, let's just start with your family. Tell me about your family growing up.
Which, by the way, everyone listening, I didn't know who Ross was when I met him, but I could tell the moment that I met him over Zoom. By the way, we still haven't been in the flesh ever. that he was special, magical, and that we were going to be homies in some kind of way and collaborators. But anyways, my childhood. I grew up in a really, like, I always try to say, like, the Brady Bunch, except for that my parents are still married and sure. I don't have stepbrothers and sisters, but it was sort of, I feel like very idealistic in a lot of ways. My parents met when they were in high school. They went to Anaheim High School. They met when they were like 15. They're still in love. They still hold hands. They're still like, they're like the ultimate married couple, in my opinion. And I'm the second born. My older brother is Eric Stefani. He was a very talented, eccentric, hyper creative artist basically my whole life that I look up to. I looked up to still. And then I have a little sister who's now a school teacher, and she's the only one that was really smart and like went to Berkeley and then UCLA, and now she's a school teacher. She has three kids. And then I have a little brother who you just met, Todd Stefani, who does like all of my kind of creative stuff with me. He films me and he's also my homie, and we do everything together. So basically grew up as kind of a passive person. Didn't have any dreams, much dreams or anything, just didn't know what I was going to do. I think the main thing that I've discovered was I had dyslexia, which I just recently started kind of talking about publicly, not meaning to, but just because these intimate conversations that we have is just the truth. And I think that that was a thing that really made me the kind of person that I was then, kind of in the shadow because of my fear of that, but didn't really realize that that was why. And also because I had a brother that was overshadowing me with his incredible talent. So, didn't really think of myself as anything more than just a girl that played Barbies and, you know, did what my brother told me to do.
What kind of music was around the house?
A lot of music. So my dad and mom were into bluegrass and folk. So we listened to like everything. And also cause I was 1969, it was like all about the 70s and like all of that kind of, I guess you'd call it yacht rock now, which is my favorite kind of music. But yeah, we listened to anything from a lot of Bob Dylan to, you know, Emmylou Harris, just all over the map. But my dad played guitar. They used to actually be in a band together. My mom played auto harp.
What was their 50s, 60s, 70s era? Auto harp is a lost art. What was their band called?
They didn't really have a band name. I mean, the thing is, my dad is an Italian American. My mom, they're both from Anaheim. They sort of like, my dad had to work his way up. Like he was the firstborn and sort of put himself through college, and then they got married and, you know, we were like, their dream is just to have kids. And that was to have a family. And we were Catholic. We went to church every week. It was very like, it seemed very typical, you know, but then looking back at it, it was actually quite unusual because it was so typical, you know what I mean? And it was sort of like traditional, and our family was the way that they brought us up. Like we were, our family is the most important thing. And these are our morals. These are our values. And you would never be in a band and think you're going to make it. Like that was your hobby, and you're going to go to school and you're going to like do something with your life. But
we've talked a lot about how religion is a, you know, it's obviously a big part, or spirituality, and your connection to, you know, to religions is really powerful. But you all, one of the things you mentioned a few times is how the people around you, I guess we can get more into this once we get into the band, but that you would stay at home, that you were such a good kid. You were like the goodest.
You know, it's like, I tried to be good. I want to be good. I still want to be good. And I think that my parents instilled really good morals. And because of being a Catholic girl and learning all those things and being in youth group and everything that probably people think I'm in this like band, this ska punk, whatever kind of band, And I was, exposed to a lot of things. And, but I just never, I just always wanted to be a good person. I lived at home till I was 26 years old. And that was just because I really liked my parents and I didn't know what else to do. Like I was going to school. When I went to school because of my learning challenges in high school, I almost failed high school. Like I almost didn't graduate, but not because I'd ever done drugs or, had sex or any of the things that you would think. It was because I just had a hard time. I had to like cheat my way through to just try to barely graduate, you know, and I'm not a cheater, but I had to survive, you know. It wasn't until I had children that I realized that I was probably had a learning disability. My little brother, who was 4 years younger, he was able at that time to figure it out. So he got to go to special classes and get some coping mechanisms, but at that time they didn't know a lot about dyslexia. And so, but I think it's one of my gifts because dyslexia has given me the gift that I have to be a songwriter and do everything that else I do.
Yeah. I was going to say the same thing that I found that that's something you and I can share is being, you know, having dyslexia, and it's a, it gives you an opportunity to see a lot of things backwards. And to me, I found it to be an advantage that whenever you see words backwards, it always ends up being or intertwined or letters being backwards or whatever it is. It gives you the ability to think of phrases you wouldn't normally think of. And it starts, for me, I think it's actually an advantage in a lot of ways. As long as I don't have to read in public.
Well, I feel like also it helps you to, in music, there's is no rules. So for me, when I first wrote my first song lyrically, I was like, oh, like I can say so much in this, these few amount of words, and I don't have to follow. I don't even know what a vowel really is. You know what I mean? Like I was like, I don't have to like follow. This is a long time ago. Like I don't have to follow any rules. Like I can just say it all. And it, and this word can mean so much. And the, like a thesaurus was like everything to me. Like when you used to be able to get those little spell check thesauruses that are like this big, and it would just, it was so exciting. Like I'm a researcher. Like I love to like look up a theme. And if you give me a theme, then I can run with it. And I can like I will be obsessively on that theme until someone says, you've got to stop. You know what I mean? So it, that's one of my gifts, I think, as well, is to be able to be obsessive and to be able to like roll with the theme. And I rolled with that theme with songwriting. As soon as I discovered that I could do it, which I had no idea, because Eric, my older brother, was the one that did all the songwriting. I just did whatever he told me, like, and I looked up to him, and I just wanted to, I was always just come over to his house. He'd be up all night long smoking cigarettes. He smoked cigarettes. But he wasn't a bad guy at all, but he would do animation. So he'd be up all night and he'd be like, he'd have peanut butter sandwiches and Fritos and, you know, be like writing all these songs. Like we would have band practice, and then he would have written like three songs in the night, and we'd come back feeling like fools, like we have nothing to offer. And Eric wrote Don't Speak while we were like at home. You know what I mean? Like, so it was like always in his shadow of his creativity. I never really like dove too much into mine. And it wasn't until I had like a trauma that I had to get those songs out and realize that I could do it, you know?
But how did you learn that you should be even a singer? I mean, obviously you're in a family where music's a big thing, so I'm sure you sang a lot growing up, but there's a difference between singing around a house and then, you know, being in a band with your, you know, with your brother. Tell me about how it starts.
Okay. Well, first of all, singing wise, I think the first time that I always sang, like I would be the one in the back of the car going to church singing every lyric to all those songs, like on the radio. And my parents would be like, why do you know all this? I'm like, I don't know. But I think that like I saw Evita, that musical, when that came out, my uncle and aunt took us to LA and We saw that, and I got really into that record. And then also the other big record was Sound of Music. First time I saw that, we went, you know, to the Cinedome in Orange County, and it was like, it was just such a huge impact on me. I think everything about it, like the Catholic nun, the, you know, the kids, like the costumes, the story, the love story, just so much about that was a huge impact on me. So I would be singing those songs, and I could tell that when I physically sang, it felt really good. Like, and I felt like I knew I could sing it. Like I could, it wasn't like I was a great opera singer or something, but I liked how it felt when I would sing. And as a little girl, I didn't go, oh, I want to be a singer when I grow up. But by the time I was in high school, I was like, dang it, if I could be a Kentucky Fried Chicken jingle writer and like I could sing those commercials, I bet I could do that. Or if my parents would let me, I could be the girl at the Disneyland Hotel in the like the saloon being like, where are you from? Well, I'm from Anaheim. You know, I could sing to, I could do that. I could wear the feather boa, like, but they wouldn't let me because it was late at night and you couldn't stay out late at night because it's dangerous. But yeah, I just had those kinds of dreams, like little ones. And you know, the Annie soundtrack, that was huge when that movie came out as a child. You know, Sean Cassidy, that was the first single ever got. I have a picture of me like on a microphone with the Sean Cassidy record. But, know, we used to play house, and my dad had built us this like playhouse in our backyard, and me and my cousin would play, and everything was sung. It was a musical. You know what I mean? We're geeks.
I love
But when I was also only 17 when my brother was like, you know, really getting into ska music, and they had discovered this music that was from, you know, England, and this band called Madness. And it was really Madness was the band that he really got into. And, you know, he was older than me, so he would be like, okay, now we're listening to this and bring the records home. And it was like, hey, and new MTV and everything that everybody else was into. But when we discovered Madness, it felt like this kind of underground weird music. And it was, they really sang about their culture in Camden Town and London. So that became like this big, like, you know, thing that we looked up to, like, oh, England and London and that music and Stiff Records. And like, then that led us into like reggae and all the other ska bands that were, they were all united and everybody, it was like a scene. And then we slowly discovered that there was like a scene in Orange County of and around, like in Riverside, that there was all these mods and skas. And so my brother, he was older, so he would go like to like Circle, I think it was like called Circle City. And it was this, you know, in Orange County, you could go and there was like a club where all these people would hang out. I didn't get to go to that. I was too young. But then even later on, Studio K, I think it was called, at Knott's Berry Farm, you would go on a certain night and like people that were like into ska and mod would be there and you would see like, oh my God, they're from like Buena Park, but he's dressed like me. Like he's dressing like how I dress. You know what I mean? And it was a lot of, it was mostly guys. Seemed like there was a lot of girls in the scene, and there certainly wasn't any other ska girls in my high school at Loera in Anaheim. So, it was just really all about kind of finding your identity through the music and trying to be, wanting to be different and trying to fit in. But, you know, I had an older brother that kind of took me under his wing. So I kind of automatically was in that world.
When you guys did your first show, where was it? And that's if people have seen you perform, you embody it. You love the movement on stage. You love like the part, it's not just you singing, it's that you love being on stage. There's such a joy in that. Did you have that from show number one, or do you ever get nervous, or was it just sort of, this is cathartic, you know, what is it that makes you a front woman the way you are? And were you always that way?
That's a good question. Honestly, when the band started back in the day, how it started was we were having a, you know, high school talent show. And so Eric, my brother, he had a bunch. I mean, there must have been like 15 people on stage, and we were all in this band called Apple Corps. That was going to be our name. And I had made the dress that basically Maria in The Sound of Music wears when she sings, I have confidence in sunshine. And it was this like tweed dress that the actual kids inside the movie say to her, that's the ugliest dress I've ever seen. And so me and my mom made that dress so I could wear it on stage when we were going to do The Selector on my radio, which is a ska band we used to listen to. And Eric was playing the accordion and all these other guys. And basically, there was a guy at my school. He was basically one of the only African-American kids that wanted to start a ska band. And this is before he had dreadlocks. But he was ska as well. And his name was John Spence. And so he was the one that convinced Eric to, get a keyboard. And then there was another kid called Jerry McMahon who didn't even play guitar, but my dad taught him a few chords. And then he was the guitar player. We were kids, children, you know. I didn't think much about it, but Eric was just kind of like, you're going to sing. But I was not the lead singer. I was the background singer, and John was the lead singer. And John had, all this charisma. He would copy basically all those, a Fishbone or all these Bad Brains and all these bands that were very crazy. And he would do backflips on stage, and it was all about being hyper and punk. So it was a ska punk. I don't know. It was just us, who knows, trying to find something. But yeah, when I first went on stage that day as Applecore, I had literally the lyrics on a paper written out, and I was on my microphone, singing the words, because I couldn't remember the words, of course not. And that was my first experience of being on stage. And then we decided we were going to really make a band. It was going to be Applecore, and then everybody fights and drops out. And eventually it turned into No Doubt. And the first show we ever played, it was probably it's hard for me to really remember, but a backyard party, but we did a lot of playing in the garage, just practicing fun. But it was fun. They were shows for ourselves. My dad would film us, we had our big, huge, V8, what are those cameras called? My brother's here, my little brother's here.
VHS
when they first came out, I don't remember. I just remember playing these backyard parties, and then the cops would come, and my parents let us use their brand new Astro van. And it's so weird to remember all these things.
Well,
so,
what's interesting is during this time, when you guys are first becoming a band, there's this scene that's brewing out of the Northwest. That's really sort of, alternative music being grunge or alternative music being something different than the scene that was happening in the OC. What's happening between, early 90s up to Tragic Kingdom is, are some of these other bands that are also big, like Sublime and some of these, there's a movement that's happening. I think it seems like everyone was trying to move to the Northwest, and it seems like what you guys were doing had this authentic Southern California sound. Did you realize that you were doing something, or when did you realize you were doing something commercially relevant? Was it when you got your record deal?
The long story short version of to try to evolve into the sound was what happened was the first year we were together, John, who really is ultimately the person that named the band No Doubt and wanted us to be a band and, made Eric at the keyboard. He ended up killing himself the first year we were together. He was 18 years old and had zero idea that he had any issues. It was right before Christmas. We were going to be having our big concert, which was going to be at the Roxy. It was our first big thing. And basically that was a huge, obviously, tragedy. And we decided as kids, we were 17, 18, and we were he would want us to keep going, all of that kind of stuff. And I think that I can remember after that, basically, we had zero idea. We knew we were making the kind of music that would never get on the radio, because the kind of music we were doing was quirky and fun and silly. And we knew that Nirvana and all that was coming. And that was just rock and cool. And we would never, we were geeks that would never get there. But for whatever reason, because I think we were born into this scene that was kind of already happening, like you could go, the first really big show we ever played was at Fender's Grand Ballroom, which was a place where it was in Long Beach, which is like one town over from Anaheim. And it was like a big ballroom, and we were the opening band, I think, of a, probably 15 different bands. There was like knife fights. It was a lot of skinheads, because there was like the good skinheads and the bad skinheads. And when we made our band, it was like we had all different kind of people in our band. And our, the idea was that we were like this imitation generation of the third wave of ska, which was in the 70s, they were trying to, like, you know, be united and be anti-racist. And we thought, oh, that's so cool. Like, yeah, you know, that's gross. Racism sucks. And like, you know, so we thought we were doing something as children, like to try to be part of something to make a difference, you know? But yeah, I'm saying, like, I remember after John died, and then Alan, who was going to then sing with me, he was a kid at the time that was in the band. He was playing trumpet. And then he moved on to being like, we were singing harmonies together. And then he at 15 got his girlfriend pregnant, and then he was out. So then, so then I ended up doing this show, and I can remember the show very specifically, walking from the show to the car afterward. And it was a club. And I had like one of those out of body experiences on stage where I just, it, whatever God gave me, it just came out and it was there. And it was like, okay, this bitch knows how to do this shit right here. Like, I just like, I knew what to do. And I just was like, I just was, it was like, I was in completely a different, the person you see on stage was there. And it was like, I know how to do this. I don't know how. I know how to write these songs, and I know how to do this, and I don't know how. Nobody taught me. And it just, it was felt very like real and there and present. And it was from that moment on, I just had this confidence and just obsession with wanting to figure out what the next outfit was going to be that I was going to wear when we did our next show. And it was, we had a band account. We had, you know, we were just all about, like, we had the flyers, we had, we promoted ourselves, like, but we were already built into this, this kind of like scene. Then slowly, as time was going on, our music was changing. Like, we were incorporating, we were being like inspired by bands like Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know, who were getting really big, Fishbone, and like, even like, you know, bands that were sort of fusing different kinds of genres together, because we didn't want to just do ska, because ska started feeling a little bit like there was so many ska bands coming out. It started, I think, feeling like we're not just that, you know what I mean? We, you know, Tony was in the band now. Red Hot Chili Peppers was his favorite band. Flea was his idol. So then we were doing, so we were like starting to like fuse things together. I think that at that time, our audience started to be a little bit offended about that. Like, we started not being just a ska band. And I mean, this is over, I don't know how many years we're talking about, a few years, but we just evolved into whatever we were from just the group of people that were in the band at that point. Then we had Tom, who was this heavy metal guy from Irvine that like was in a heavy metal band with his sister. You know what I mean? And then we got Adrian, who was basically a liar, who said that he had been playing drums, but literally was just a fan of No Doubt and learned our demo and then tried out. And because he was really good looking and hardworking, we chose him. You know what I mean? So obviously you evolve with the different members that were coming in, and that's, I don't know what the question was, but yeah, it's definitely not trying to make it, but definitely trying to make the next show. Like, when are we going to get another show?
There are all the bands that you mentioned that were inspiration for you guys. None of them have a woman in the band. I mean, what is it like? Did was that fun to be? Oh well, we're the band in the circuit with the being you as the front person, or was it sort of, this is so strange that you're the only front woman out of that entire?
I still, one of my other gifts is that I don't remember much. so I think that's probably why, because I was very, very passive. I didn't really think a lot about it. The one thing I did know is that I had the safety of the fact that I had my older brother in the band who, you know, I did everything with. He was my best friend. And he was kind of the band leader because he wrote all the songs. Nobody else barely could play their instruments. You know what I mean? Tom was actually really good. And Tony was good too, but Adrian became really good. But I'm saying I didn't, think about that. I just knew that they were very protective of me. And when John died, you know, I'm the one that said to Tony, like way, way early on, like basically the first time I ever saw him come on Mel's Lane in Anaheim to come try out for No Doubt. He walked across, you know, out of his car with his bass and his Huarache sandals. And I was like, I'm in love with you. And I'm going to kiss you one day. And it was like an obsession. And, you know, finally got him to kiss me. But it was understood that nobody gets with me. Like, I'm off limits, you know? So, and I was never like a sought after in high school. Like, no, I wasn't like a... like, oh, there's a cute girl or anything. It was like, no, nobody, you know what I mean? I didn't have any boyfriends. Like,
that's so hard to imagine when, you know, I mean, I know this is, like you said, you lived with your parents till you were 26, and that's really, you know, Tragic Kingdom coming out kind of era. But like to think of the Don't Speak video and you know, all the spider webs and all those videos that were coming out at that time, and to think that you weren't sought after, that has to be something that was internal. And
no, it was not because I just wasn't, I was a very slow, I blossomed in a very slow way. Like in high school, I was quite like chunky and, you know, nerdy and like not in the cool group or anything. Trust me. And it wasn't until, like, cause I basically graduated at 17. The band started right around the end of my senior year. And it was, you know, I went to Disneyland graduation where you go and stay up all night. That was where I had my graduation party. And then me and Tony started seeing each other, but it was behind everyone's back. And when John died, that's when everyone kind of found out that we had kissed and we were together. And basically at that point, things changed because I felt like I had Tony as my like best friend. Like we did everything together. And then I had Eric and I was in this band. And so I didn't really think about being the only girl. I just felt like I was, you know, I had my boyfriend and I had my best friend and my brother, and it was like a family. And I didn't really think about it. I don't know why. And when we played these shows, there were other bands that came later. Like there was like Dance Hall Crashers. They had a girl, you know, there was, I'm trying to think of some other ones, but that was we're talking way early. You know, once we started like getting to really be established and have like a manager and like,
it's all changes when Tragic Kingdom comes out, you know, you had a couple albums before that, but there's something different when you have, you know, just a handful of smashes plus Grammy nominations and the whole thing. I imagine that there are plenty of bands after that where people emulate, you know, and try to be similar to what you guys were doing. You know, when you become famous, how does that affect a person who had been quiet and private, except for when she's on stage? What was it like to bring that with you outside of performing? Does that make sense?
I think really the big thing that happened was when Eric left the band. That was when my life was starting. Like I was like, I don't even know how to exist, because that was everything. That was my whole, like I had just started writing songs. Like the first song that I wrote not on my own, but lyrically and like melodies and things was the song called Different People. that eventually ended up on the Obama playlist, which is just so crazy to me because it's like, I never even know how to write a song. But Eric was writing all the music up until that point. We would write together. He would love for me to be sitting there writing with him or whatever. But when he was going to leave, it was like, what do we do? Like, you know, he was going to Cal Arts. He was, you know, he'd already worked at The Simpsons as an animator for 10 years, like, but he wanted to go to Cal Arts. And he was driving back and forth in his Nissan Sentra, and it just was like not working out. And then at the same time, basically, Tony dumps me. So I was like living at my parents', going to college, but barely like, you know, getting through. I did way better in college than I did in high school because I wanted to do good. And I had Tony to help me with all of my work because he was really good.
This is during Tragic Kingdom or before?
The making of Tragic Kingdom, because the Tragic Kingdom, remember, like I had written Just a Girl with Tom probably a year and a half before it came out, that song, you know what I mean? So like we had been trying to put a record out for so long because we put a record called No Doubt out that got basically shelved. We put it out. We went on tour in our van and we were playing next to like record stores and stuff. And our record wasn't even in there and they wouldn't give us the record to even sell out of the back of our truck. So we were just like, nobody was at these shows. It was terrible.
We were on Trauma or is that?
That was on Interscope. Okay. So meanwhile, we were so mad about it that we decided to put our own record out behind their backs. And we put out this record called the Beacon Street Collection, which is basically all the duds from the Tragic Kingdom leading that we knew weren't going to be on there. That was just a quirky, weird record for the fans. And we kept saying, a record's going to come out. It's going to come out. Never did. And so by the time Tragic Kingdom was finally, cause they had put us in with this, producer called Albie Gluten, who had done like the Bee Gees. And like, we were like so excited. We were working with this amazing guy. We loved him. And then they pulled the plug on that. Then they finally put us in with Matthew Wilder, who wrote Ain't Nothing Gonna Break My Stride. Yeah. And they were like, this is the guy you're gonna work with. Well, at that point, I don't think my brother was really good at like collaborating or wanting to be, you know, diluted or even helped at all. And so he was having all those issues. We were trying to work with Matthew, but Matthew was incredible because we could never finish songs. You know, you worked with me, so you see how I write. Imagine that I was doing all of it, like all of the melodies at this point, all of the lyrics, and, you know, the guys we were just homemade. Like we didn't know anything like about anything. And so it took us so long to finish anything. And so Matthew was there to really help us learn how to finish the songs. And that took forever. But during that time, after Tony broke up with me, is when I really started writing because I had to get that out. I was out and Eric was quitting. So my life was over and I wrote one after another. It was like, you know, a song called Ended on This, Don't Speak, all of them it was all during that time, but it took a long time. And that's when Tragic Kingdom was finally finished and Eric had quit at that point. And he said he would finish the record. And there was the last song I think I wrote was a song called Ended on This. And I remember going in with Eric and it was really weird because it was like he was still going to be on the record and he was still playing on it, but he was quit. And it was like, it was a weird feeling. And Tony we were broken up, but we were still in the band and it was awful.
After it was successful, how did that change either Eric's choice to leave? And, you know, it was interesting that you say it was awful. Because I think a lot of people assume, oh, if you're having a really successful album, a lot of musicians who aspire to be musicians look at, like, that's the pinnacle, is to have these hits out there. But meanwhile, the behind the scenes are really complicated, you know?
It was super complicated. Like, I can't even believe it. Like, I can't even, there's no way for me to, and we've talked a lot about this, me and you, off this podcast in our writing sessions, but so many layers were happening at that time. And you asked me like, how did I be like all of a sudden the public person or whatever, a famous person. But that was a really like an overnight thing, because it was like basically they decided to put out Just a Girl. And, you know, K-Rock, which was the only station we cared about getting on, told us, the program director said, it would take an act of God for No Doubt to be on this radio station. And so that's another proof that God is real. And we got, I remember calling in, like trying to get, you know, play No Doubt, play Just a Girl, and all sitting around and recording it on our tapes. And we got, you know, we got on the radio and we went to record and make the video for Just a Girl. And we went straight from that video shoot to the plane, and we went on tour, and we were gone for 2.5 years on tour. That's where it was really, really, really hard, because I was so in love and dependent on Tony. And we had to sit in interviews and talk about a record that I wrote about my heart being literally sliced and bleeding still, and sit with this guy that was my best friend. And then he was being like, how could you leave her? Because then suddenly I look like I'm all hot and like, you know, like, well, how could you do that? Like, she's great. But it wasn't until suddenly I'm famous that people think I'm great, because I was just nobody before, like, Just a Girl came out, you know? So it was like every interview. And then on top of that, it was just me and Tony having the issues, but everybody wanted to take me because I was a girl and put me, and I was the singer, and it was my story, right? My voice out here. And that was a real problem for the band. You know, it was really, you know, you can't be on this, you know, unless we're all on the album cover, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. And unless, you know, I guess if it's a fashion magazine, you can be on it, but we have to be part, you know. It was all these, like, all of these politics between us in the band.
No matter how much you tell people, like, being in a band sucks.
It does and it doesn't. We had a lot of fun together, and, you know, we had a lot of chemistry.
Yeah.
And we were really good on stage, because we practiced really hard and we took it seriously, and we knew we were good, and everybody had something to contribute as far as what role they played live. I think as a live band, because we played for 9 years before Just a Girl ever got on the radio, by the time we got, you know, basically forced by Trauma Records at this point to go on tour opening for Bush and the Goo Goo Dolls, basically we knew that, I knew, like, it didn't even matter. I'd put my rollerblades on before, after sound check, I would do my little rollerblade, and then I would get my makeup on, put my outfit, the one outfit I had to wear on that tour. And I knew I was going to, it didn't matter if there was like a third of the audience, you know, and these arenas were full, I was going to kill it. And by the end, like, they were loading in people, and I knew by the time I did Just a Girl, I would have slaughtered the entire audience. And it was this confidence that I don't even know. I think it was coming from all of the anxiety of the breakup and the Tony and the band and and being alone and going from my parents' house to being on tour with all guys and the tension and looking out the window of my, you know, tour bus and seeing girls and going, you know, these girls are not against me. These are girls are for me.
Yeah.
You know, it went from like, oh, what she thinks she doing on stage? Like, hey, bitch. Yeah. And then to like, that's my girl. And they're dressing like me and they're Gwennabies. Like, what? Like, it was like this weird shift from like this weird kind of like underground thing to like, I don't know, like, I'm me. And, you know, I dyed my hair blonde. Like, all these things happened like through the breakup. And then it was like world knowledge that the breakup, it was very complicated. Very lucky to not be absolutely mentally ill at this point.
The next two albums, Tragic Kingdom, you know, well, let's just jump to Tragic Kingdom. And in this segment, we're going to say, what would Glenn Ballard ask Gwen Stefani on And the Writer Is?
Okay.
He has this anecdote. He says, Simple Kind of Life, was written by herself on my high-strung D18 at my old studio in Encino. I subsequently gave her a high-string guitar. I hope she still plays that magic song. He's a sweet man. He says, as a lifelong athlete, this is an aside, but he goes, as a lifelong athlete, I have always been impressed with her dedication to staying fit. What's her new workout? It used to be 3 hours daily.
LOL. That's Glenn. Glenn said that.
Yeah.
That was, I was always trying to have a perfect body, but also it took that kind of dedication to be able to do the kind of show that we did, because our show is quite physical, you know, and that came from wanting to be like Fishbone or like all those bands we were talking about earlier. But Simple Kind of Life was the first song I ever wrote on my own. I came home from the Tragic Kingdom tour and I was 29 years old. I had been with Gavin now, you know, this whole time. I was really not happy at all. I mean, we're talking about not happy. Broken up, cheating, did all the stuff that happened during that time. And also wanting to come home and be taken really seriously as a band and as a writer, you know, and trying to go in and write those songs it just took so long. I mean, we talked about this before, like some of the songs that me and you've written were written in seconds because of you. I just felt like everything was on my shoulders as far as writing these songs. Eric wasn't involved at this point. We rented a house up in Mulholland and at Woodrow Wilson at this like hippie house. And we would just go there every day and try to like beat our heads against the wall, trying to write songs. And then Glenn Ballard came into the picture. And again, finally somebody that could help us finish some songs. And I remember they were upstairs and he had tuned this guitar, just like he said. And at that point I was like, I'm going to learn how to play guitar because I don't want to be dependent on everyone, you know, to write these songs. I want to write a song and like say, I don't want to have to tell Tom, no, not there. No, not there. No, not there. Like, you know, when you're trying to get him to play the chords you want. And I just started playing and I just, it came out, this song. I was like, I just wrote a song and I ran upstairs. I was like, I think I wrote a song. And I started playing it for him. And there was Simple Kind of Life. And
I mean, yeah. That's crazy.
It was crazy. That's why I believe in the Lord. Like, we can bring that up again because it is crazy. It's like, how do I sit there not knowing how to play guitar? Not knowing what I'm doing at all and just write a song. Like, it just came out of my mouth, like, you know. But yeah, that was an amazing moment. I never wrote another one on a guitar by myself. So,
that's beyond nuts. But you know, Rocksteady's also a big album, and you guys at this point have had three really significant albums. And without going through each song, and you know, clearly after that, we start to learn about you as a solo musician. You know, I mean, it's, you were still, you know, part of No Doubt for a while, but it's only a few years after that that we really, you know, you come out as a solo musician.
I think you're really right. And I think what the biggest difference and the biggest thing was, everybody was humbled by Return of Saturn, which there's some amazing songs on that record. And it was almost like if we could have just edited a little bit, it would have been a really good record. But some of my favorite lyrics I've ever written are on that album. I can't listen to it. Return of Saturn, it's so painful for me. There's so much that is revealed in that record on songs that probably most people don't know that were so telling of the future. And even talking about it makes me want to cry. But Rocksteady was a revelation because the band, because of being humbled by not being as successful on our sophomore record, and even the tour and everything, they were like open to writing with other people and collaborating. And the label was really pushing. Jimmy was always really pushing for us to work, you know, outside of our genre, and which I think is, and one of the groups that I really wanted to work with, what I really wanted and Jimmy wanted me to work with was Pharrell. And Pharrell at that point hadn't worked outside of, you know, hip hop, you know? And so we went into the studio and, Pharrell was Pharrell, like a super babe, like riding around on a Razor scooter inside, like whatever that super fancy, studio he used to work at. Just a pimp. I mean, like, and just so hip hop, but not like true to what he is, like nerd, you know, nerd hip hop guy, fashion guy. Like, and I was just so blown away by him. And it was like a perfect, person for me to look in the eye and go, yeah, we're going to do something different right now. And I just knew it. I knew it. I can remember standing in the hallway and just being like, so mesmerized by him and his beauty in and out. And he played a couple of tracks. So we've never written to tracks. This is, imagine back then hip hop was being born. So for us, it was, there was certain lines, like Tony's like a huge hip hop fan, you know, but we were No Doubt. Like, so you don't do this or you don't do that. You don't wear it in, you know, we have to have real drums, or there was all these rules. And we were about to break them big, you know, and he played us that beat to Hella Good, which is basically Michael Jackson. And, and I had the idea that I wanted to write a song called Hella Good, 'cause I had been up touring and up north, and I'm like, yeah, you know, that's like a cool thing to say. And we just wrote it right then and there, and the whole band was in the room, but it was like, he had the dun 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 dun. He had that melody for the chorus, and I just came with the verse. And, I wanted to write a song that was about, that was lighthearted, like a dance song, you know, and, didn't have to be say too much. 'Cause some of those dance songs, they don't say anything, you know? Why can't we? So that was that song. And it almost didn't make it on the record. You know, the band didn't want to put that on there at first. And I kept hearing, listening back to the demo going, what are you doing? You know? And, but yeah, that record was really fun. We were going out every night to clubs, dancing and coming, staying up all night writing. We were, you know, deep into like dance hall and working with all kinds of different, we got to work with Rick Ocasek. We made a wish list of people and we got to work with all of them. So yeah, I mean, that was just one of those records where everybody was open and collaborating. And for me, my best work is when I collaborate. So
when you start releasing solo music, you know, it's a sonic shift. But it looked like it was very freeing. I don't know if it was or not. But once you start releasing solo music, there was this, there was always respect for your band. It's a Grammy winning nominated band. But when you started releasing music solo, all that respect kept following you, and there was a big embrace. Were you vulnerable? Was it freeing? Was it releasing your own music outside of having the history you had with those guys? What was that like?
It's hard to, I want to be really honest about where my head was at, because I've had a lot of guilt about doing it, because I didn't even call it a solo record. I called it a dance record, because I just knew that, there was a lot of music in me that was like from high school that wasn't just ska. Like, just like to paint the picture, Anaheim was West Side Anaheim, where I lived at Loera. And then there was Anaheim High School, which was East Side. And East Side was a little more Latino. And my, like, basically that's where Tony went to school. And the music was things like freestyle, like, you know, Debbie Deb, Lisa Cult Jam, like a lot of kind of pop, going into pop as well, but there was like I thought it was kind of more underground dance that I loved so much. And, I wanted to do like almost not make fun of it, but make a fun, like almost like a guilty pleasure dance record. And when basically what had happened, we'd never had a break and a hiatus or anything. And Adrian had just gotten married and had his first baby, and we were just sort of going to take a break. And it was literally, like I said, these ideas don't come from me. Like, it was just like light bulb. I got to do this. And I just was like, I got to do it. And me and I said to Tony, I want to do this. And Tony's the one that listened to all that music back. He's the one, he listened to Prince. He listened to Lisa, all that stuff. And I said, we could do this together. Like we could make a fun record of that kind of music that we love, you know, from high school. And so we just started writing and it was really fun. And Tony was in a phase where he was really trying to learn how to write in a different way. He learned like piano and different things that he never did before. And then I was like, I want to do the circuit, which I didn't even know existed of, you know, I just went to Jimmy and I said, Jimmy, let's go. Like, I want to work with everybody. Let's, you know, you tell me who to do it with. You know, I didn't even know that there was writers like that. I just didn't even know it existed. So I went out and I think the first session I took was with Linda Perry, who Born on Blondes were on Interscope. So I knew her through that, but she also had just written that beautiful song for Christina. So she was all hot at the moment. And she, I was scared and I was intimidated to like, cause I, again, being dyslexic and not knowing how to play an instrument really, or know how I even write a song. Cause I just, it just happens. I didn't know if that was going to work if I go in with someone I don't know. And she was the one that said, what are you waiting for, bitch? And I was like, look at that, he's stuck in a moving car, a scary car. And I wrote, what you waiting for? And it was like every person I went in with after that was, all I had to do was play the last song I wrote. It was like a fire. Like people were so into it. And I remember one of the last songs I did was with Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis. Like I did this song, Harajuku Girls, which is, I even like, you know, some songs that you write, you can say they're a masterpiece, even though you're not being conceited, because I don't know how it even came. Like it's so, the lyrics are so crazy. The melodies are so crazy. I remember exactly when it happened. So yeah, there was a way to be completely self-indulgent and creative, because I wasn't trying to make hits and I was doing something that was just like a fun side project. And that's what Love Angel Music Baby ended up being. So, so happy I did it.
Holla Back Girl. I know a lot of these songs come in that and after, but Rich Girl, Cool, Sweet Escape, the success of these songs, those are huge, and there are obviously a bunch of others on there. It starts to make you your own, on your own, it launches you into your own journey. You start a fashion line, probably Lamb probably starts around then.
Yeah.
You know, we've had a lot of conversations about the things that sort of happened from then until even now. Mm-hmm. I know you released a lot of music between then. Sort of tell me about finding yourself after that level of success as a soloist. The band had been on hiatus, so then there's almost, you know, there's a new phase of who you are after the success of you as a solo artist. Tell me about Lamb until essentially now. Lamb until The Voice.
Okay. Oh, yeah. God. This is so good for me. Thank you. I think that when I did the first solo record, I didn't feel finished. I felt very rushed. And I had told the band I wasn't going to go on tour. I'm just doing it for fun, blah, blah, blah. But it was so full of life. It was a world that had been unleashed, you know, like you said, like the fashion side of it, the artwork side of it. There was so much. I had just gotten married, you know. And then what had happened was I said, I'm just going to tour and do a short tour, just because I had done one live show in Europe and I said, I have to do this. Like I have to see what it is live. I'm alive. I'm not even a record maker. I'm a live performer. That's what I am, you know? So I did a short tour. Of course, you know, during rehearsals, I get pregnant, for the first time ever. And I'm like a complete bitch and don't know what's wrong with me. And I find out that I'm pregnant with Kingston and I twist my ankle working out before the tour. So I'm pregnant and I have a brand new band. I have never done costume changes. I have dancers. I'm pregnant and all the rest. So I go on that first tour. It was really hard. I was very sick. I had this big secret that I was pregnant and, I felt ripped off. Like I didn't really get to enjoy that tour. So I also had all these other songs left over that didn't make the record that were still really good songs. And if I really just went in the studio, wrote a few more songs, I'd have a whole nother record. And so Jimmy was like, you have to go in with this guy, Akon. And I was like, well, I don't really see how I'm going to do that. My baby's 5 weeks old. And I don't want to go in with Akon because he is an African rapper. Okay. I don't really see how that really has anything to do with me, you know? Anyways, he's like, if there's anything you do in your whole life, please take this session. So I get the baby nurse. We go to the session and I meet my homie Akon, who's like instantly, we have everything in common and we write a song called Sweet Escape. And, together, like just, he's super talented, but I was doing my thing as well. So it was felt very like meant to be. And that was that record. So then I ended up saying, I'm going to do a world tour. I got to do it. And, you know, I felt guilty because I know the band was waiting on me basically. And I had every intention to go back and do the band after that. But I took the baby and I toured the world. And the month that I got home, I did 120 shows. I don't know. And I got pregnant that month with my second baby. And the band was like, fuck you. Like, you know, how do you do that? Like, and then I was determined. I was like, I'm going to write this record pregnant. Like, it's going to be fine. Like, I have a toddler and I'm going to be able to do it all. And nope, couldn't do it. Got super fat. Like, I had the baby. And then, like, right after Zuma was born, my manager and we had like a lunch meeting. He was like, how about you go on tour and get inspired for the No Doubt record? And I was like, great idea. So I had 4 months to lose 50 pounds and have two babies to get ready to go on this No Doubt tour where that's where we went out and we did like, I think it was the Greatest Hits tour. I think it was an amazing tour. And felt every night like I was going to die. Like every night I had visions of the ambulance scraping me off the stage because I was just too tired. I had done a world tour. I'd put two records out. I'd had two babies. I had nothing else to give. Like it was done. And I was married and I was, you know, so came back and started trying to write the No Doubt record, which ended up being Push and Shove, which, you know, was not a good, like not a good 3 years for me. I was not well. I was, you know, every time I left the house to go write a song, I would feel guilty. I was missing out on the kids or why would I take, I would get there and nothing would happen. No song would come out. So then I would be like, I just wasted 7 hours. I could have been home with my kids, knocking my head against like the floor. Like, and everything was really hard for us, I think at that point, because I didn't really necessarily, I felt too vulnerable to work with an outside writer. They didn't want to, they weren't bringing what they needed to bring for me to bring what I needed to bring. And it was just, and there was a lot when we started working with Spike, who was the producer, who had only mixed all of our records, but we never produced with him. It was just a lot of compromising in a way that I was going into that direction where I was creatively and they were wanting to go back. So everything, the production on the album sounds like such a huge mashup of so many things. It's like, you can't even wrap your head around it, but there are a lot of really good songs on that record, lyrics and stuff like that. It came out and it didn't do anything. And everybody was just like flying home from Europe going, what? This never happened to us before. Like, and what are we going to do now? And that's when we decided we were going to go in the studio, And at that point, things were changing. You could make more songs and put more songs out. You didn't have to just put a record out and it's over. You know what I'm saying? So Jimmy was like, here, go in with this person and that person. And we tried doing that, but it was just, again, just not working. Like not, it just, we didn't know what, it was too conflicted, I guess. So then what happened? I get a call from the Lord. Knock, knock, you're pregnant. Yeah. And I get a little baby Apollo in my belly at 43 years old, after, you know, a lot of not having babies for a long time. So that was a shock and a blessing and just what I probably needed at that time. And that's when basically he was, I think, 4 or 5 weeks old when Pharrell called me and was like, I know that you just had a baby, but I'm playing Coachella. You want to come hop on stage and do Holla Back? And I'm like sitting there like, just like after, you know, with like my body just all over the place going, I think I can make that work. And I packed the baby up and went to a sandstorm in Palm Springs and got on stage with him and did that. And then like the next day or something, my manager, he wasn't even my manager at the time, Irving, his wife called me and said, Christina Aguilera is pregnant. She can't do The Voice. You want to do it? And I was like, and my lawyer was over and my parents, and they were like, we were showing the baby off, you know, like they were just all over visiting. And I just got the craziest call. Like The Voice wants me to be on The Voice. I was like, is that a cool show? Like, my parents are like, oh my God, we watched the show. Like, you know, And I was like, I'm going to, and my niece was there and she's like, you got to do it. And then I did it. And it was the craziest thing. Cause I was nursing a baby. He was only 4 months when I started, never did anything like that before. It was so inspiring musically. Like I was like, wow, I'm surrounded by music. Oh, by the way, then I find out Pharrell is going to be on the same season. And I'm like, there's no way Pharrell's doing The Voice. I was like, there's no way. And it was true. So that was pretty awesome, too, to have somebody that I knew. But I didn't know him in that role. So it was really scary. It was really scary. And, of course, I didn't know Blake, that he even existed. And I knew Adam barely because Adam had just called me to be on one of his songs. And we had, so that it was a weird timing.
Let's talk about Blake for a second, because, you know, very sweet human, very funny human. I love how much he makes you happy. And I just want to talk about how Blake comes into your life in, you know, most people meet somebody maybe at a bar or on a dating app and you meet him, you know, a couple chairs away. So tell me about meeting Blake.
I met Blake obviously on the set of The Voice. It's so funny too, because I had a nanny at the time, a good nanny, that was from Texas that, she was like, ooh, Blake's hot. Like, yeah, that's cool. I was like, this is like a kind of more like a, she watches football and like drinks beer and like is cowboys. And you know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, you think so? I was like, I don't get that, but okay. You know, but only to later find out that she was super right. But yeah, I met Blake that first season and I remember thinking I felt so jealous of him because I felt like he was just so, it was interesting being on the show because I've never been in a competition about music. Like it was just so, and I'm not like a competitive person. So, and I don't play games and I don't feel comfortable in that. So it was very unusual that I was in this situation, but everyone kept wanting to be on Blake's team and I didn't really know who he was. And I was like, why did they want to be on his team? So I started looking up his songs and I saw this song that he had written called Over You. And then I realized that this guy is super talented. And I started getting these thoughts in my head, like, well, because I was kind of desperate at that time, because I had started right around that same time, we missed this part, I had started talking to him about doing more music to do when I was going to be on The Voice. So like, I started working with Benny Blanco. He was kind of overseeing a project for me, which was really weird. Now you have to remember, I'm old as hell. So all of a sudden you outgrow everybody and you're like a woman and you're a mom and you're like, okay, I'm going to go work with this 22-year-old boy, Benny, or whatever he was at the time. I was like, this is just weird. Like that he's trying to tell me how I should do this kind of song or who I should work with. And I'm out of touch now. And like, I'm just being honest. Like it was very strange, you know? And meanwhile, then I got pregnant during that project and I had worked with him and we had done a song called Baby Don't Cry that I changed to Baby Don't Lie. It's the first time I've ever, and that was written by Ryan Tedder. And it was this whole thing that I didn't know if I was going to put out Spark the Fire because I'd written that with Pharrell, or Baby Don't Lie. It was a whole thing. Ugh, we missed that part. Let's just, but meanwhile, being on The Voice, I just had gotten so inspired to want to do new music again, because just being around it and being in that role, it made me think so much about all of the wake of work that I had done and how I had such an unusual success from just being me, like, and being so unbelievably untrained or coached or dyslexic or all the things that I am, like, to lead up to having all of these songs. It's crazy. And to be a writer, like, I don't even know that I can write songs, but I do. I do that. So it just made me really inspired. And Blake was like a different genre. So I'd never been around like country. So it inspired me, like, to think in my fantasy that I would maybe write a song with Blake someday. Or work outside the box. Like, I wanted to work outside the box.
Songs in country now.
Huh? I know.
I mean, that's so.
You know, we're skipping over a lot because that was the first season. I didn't even know Blake. And meanwhile, like every break during that season, I'd be like nursing a baby. Like I was just had a baby. So it wasn't until the following season, which would have been 2015, right? I don't even know. Maybe it was 16. Is when we all came back to The Voice and we both found out that we were both, our lives were over and we were getting divorces. And then we started like talking and being really friendly. And yeah. And then now I'm engaged to him. Much crazy. But that was 5 years ago.
So crazy. We're going to go into our next segment. That's okay. Going to be five for five. I'm going to list five things. And I just want you to tell me first thing that comes off the top of your head.
First, I'm swollen right now, by the way.
you're killing it. We'll start with our co-writer, Luke Nicolai.
Yes. What has come to my head? Yes.
There you go.
He introduced me to you.
Oh, I like that. I like that guy. I mean, I guess before we get to that, we can even say, like, we'll go, let's finish this and then we can go into, let me reintroduce myself. Okay. Let's go with Kingston.
Oh my God. Too many words to say a one answer thing, but, honored that God chose me.
Go with Zuma.
My heart melts. Is that, are you looking for these kinds of answers?
whatever you want. There are no rules.
Yeah. Yeah, I love him.
Apollo.
Thank God. Thank God for him.
Let's do Blake Shelton.
It's too hard to do one word answers for these unbelievably like important people in my life. You know, Blake is, he saved my life and he is, you know, I feel like the one person in this world that has the same morals and standards and, you know, like, and we don't think the same, but we complement each other so well. And I just feel like I have now a chance for happiness for the rest of my life. You know, it's exciting.
Wow. love that. This next segment, John, what would John Janik, the head of Interscope, ask Gwen Stefani? He says, how is she so level-headed and an amazing person while being an icon? How are you so level-headed?
I don't feel level-headed all the time, especially how we all feel today after yesterday. I think that the one thing that's been the thread for me is when my mom planted the seed of faith in me. I think that I always come back to my faith and my belief in God and my purpose. And it's only really recently that I really truly could say without, I used to not be confident in the gift of being a songwriter or a performer, whatever I am, until now, but realizing that that truly was something handed to me, that I'm now, I get to share with people. And I just surrendered years ago and said, whatever, you show me the way. There's no other reason to be here. This is just a test. So I'm just here to participate in with my gift, the one thing that I have to offer, which is music, and hopefully being a good mom and maybe a good wife, upcoming friend, and all those other things that we get to do here. But yeah, I think it would be definitely my faith is what's kept me sane-ish.
Well, thank you for doing this. For people who don't know, who haven't had the pleasure of working with you, I don't think people realize, and this is what happens when somebody becomes an icon as an artist. A lot of people don't recognize it, that they have the capability of being a really good songwriter. And you come in with such specific ideas of what you want to write about. And that is so unusual. You don't come in, you're willing to listen to other people's ideas. You let the best ideas win. You have no ego in the room. There's so many people who are in a similar position who don't collaborate with such an open heart. And it makes it so enjoyable that we've been able to write so much together, because it's just an enjoyable process. Like, it's not, it is, you're so interactive in it, and you have ideas that are of who you want to be and what you want to say. And I hope that as you continue on this journey of this next phase of reintroducing yourself.
Your idea, by the way.
Well, I mean, man, how many songs do we have together? 9? Something like that? Like, we have a lot already.
Probably another one next week.
Yeah. I mean, you have this ability, though, to bring out the best in your collaborators because of who you are in the session. And I just really appreciate that we've developed this relationship over the last 6 months or a year or whatever it's been. But, it's so fun watching people get reintroduced to you, you know? I mean, how does it feel? You've just released this new single. How does it feel?
It's such a crazy time outside of, this music. It's hard to know what to feel like with a global pandemic, you know, so many political things going on. Everyone's scared. I'm scared. And then on top of it, I get this blessing again. Like, I get this opportunity out of nowhere. I mean, I didn't know how I was going to be able to write music again, you know? It's just how. Like, it's crazy right now. And because of Zoom, I was able to, I honestly believe that every idea I have just comes from, not from me. So I think that being able to do this more, and like that people actually, seems like I made a little splash. Like, there was actually like a little water that splashed. Like, I was standing in the kitchen the day that the song came out, and I don't know if I told you this, but Blake came in and he was like, oh my God, you're number 16. Like, iTunes, you know, I know there's lots of charts and everything means whatever it means, but iTunes is a thing. And I just burst out crying. And I didn't even know that I felt like that. I think it was because I had felt like, well, the whole reason we wrote Reintroduce Myself was feeling a bit like an underdog, or feeling a bit like over, or like that no one would really want to listen anymore, or, which I'm fine with. Like, I've had my time, like 30 years of, you know, being able to keep having blessings. I'm good. But, you know, I just, the one thing that really does still fuel my fire is writing music, and being able to share it is like another level, because it's like you get kind of addicted to that feeling of the taste of blood of sharing it with, you know what I mean? It's like having that song that you know is so good, that's so true and honest and real, and then being able to share it and have other people have that reaction or that feeling is just, it's too good, you know? So you never want it to go away, even though you grow up and be a woman and have kids and a mom. You still want to do it. So I feel like so good. I feel so good. And I think the one thing that's been great is knowing that the kind of record I wanted to make, which was a record that is full of just happiness and joy and goes right back to the beginning. And it's interesting, we just talked about the beginning, because, you know, when my son was discovering music, he's Kingston, we talked about him too. He's, you know, discovering music, and it's so crazy to watch him find, you know, he went from Green Day to now he's into like, you know, he's just into all different kinds of things. But it made me think so much about me in eighth grade, discovering ska music and discovering reggae, and how weird that is that like suddenly I'm like a reggae girl, this white girl from like Anaheim, like, what? Like, and yeah, I just wanted to kind of go back there again. And once I said that with the different collaborators that I was going to write with, everybody got so excited and it was so natural and easy. And when I met you, I think what you're really, really, really good at is getting in my head and asking the right questions. And that's probably why this podcast is such a huge success and so fun to listen to, is because the questions you ask, because you're unbelievably smart and intuitive. And I think that like by that first moment that I met you, I didn't know who you were. I didn't know. I just knew that Luke said, you got to meet my homie, like this guy, he's like my mentor. Like you got to work with Ross. And I was like, sure, I'm open to doing anything. I'll work with whoever. And I didn't know, cause you feel intimidated. Like you meet someone, and if you're me, you think they're going to think all these things and they're going to expect you to be creative and these bring all this stuff, or they're going to be judging you, or they're going to have their opinions. You just have insecurities, you know, before you go into actually get naked and like be intimate with someone you don't know over a Zoom to try to write new music after 30 years of music. So I just didn't know what to think, but I knew right away that you were a similar tone, like as far as the way that your lyrics come. And like, we have a similar sense of humor. And I think that we were on the same level when it came to like wanting to be honest and true and real and just say it and like, and be lighthearted. So there was just a chemistry and a comfortableness that happened. And after that first song, which was Let Me Reintroduce Myself, by the way, everybody, I knew that I needed to get more of you. And it was just, you know, again, like it was like that, like our, my guardian angel saying, you got to work more with us. But it feels so good. And it's not over. And I think that it's just amazing.
It's starting. It's just starting. Like these things just take a long time. And just, it's just so fun. I mean, there are so many people rooting for you. It's so fun. I'm excited for our session next week, as I always am. And send my best to Blake. And
no, I want to keep talking to you. No,
look, this is just our first episode. We'll just have to do like, we'll just have to keep doing them.
It's so cool. You're so cool, Ross. And I was saying to Blake today, I go, that guy's a really good guy. You're a really good guy. You're a good person in the world. And, I'm so happy I got to work with you and now get to talk to you on your show and be considered a writer. I'm so honored.
You're such a good writer. You're crazy. You know, and also one thing, I know that this is like, I'm still going, but a lot of artists don't even talk about collaborating. You know, they don't want it to be known that they, you know, you'd be surprised how many artists don't, and well, we don't have to go into who they are, but like there's so many that don't even want to talk about that they ever wrote the song with somebody else or that somebody produced the song or something. Instead, you're like, oh my God, I wrote this with my friends and I'm in this session with my friends here. Or, I mean, we have Busby that we're both friends with, and we have all these people that you named so many people that we're both friends with throughout this process. But that's the thing is you're always one of the writers. You totally are. No one ever thinks, you know, in the room, I mean, everyone thinks of you as one of the writers. No one's like, you don't treat people like they're, you know, like they're not peers. You just go into it and be like, you do go into it right from the get-go.
But I'm nothing, like, you're, like, just so people know, I've watched you do things that literally blow my mind. Like, I mean, I've watched you write a song while we're talking, and I'm like, when did you fucking write that? And you were like, while we were talking. I was like, but we were talking, and then you, like, actually sing a song back at me about my life. And I'm like,
you what? Say colorful things.
Huh?
You say colorful things. Really?
Well, I feel like I've learned over the time, like what my role is right now in this record. I know what my role is. I've had different roles during different records and different songs, you know, like we all kind of do, you know what I mean? So, with you, I'm going to sit back and let you take the wheel because shit, like you know, you're so talented. But my favorite thing to do is to walk back in my brain through a song and how each part happened and when it happened. And I said this, and then you said that. And then all of a sudden this part came and it was like, no, we were going to do this. And then I love it. It's just because it's such a, it's yes. I know that there's math and science behind songs and chords and Mozart and all these things that I know nothing about, but there's a magical mystery about songs and how they just all of a sudden are there. And, and especially when they're real and they talk back your life to you and they say things to you afterward that you didn't even know you were saying until you are listening back and you're like, oh my God, you were like, oh my God, my middle name's Jacob. Anyways, thank you.
Love you. I'll see you next week.
Okay. Bye.
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 Bye. There you go. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Have a good one.
I'm going to go. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silverstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.